Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Well, what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I am doing so well. How are you today?
I am really well as well, Lance, and especially doing great because of our wonderful guests on this episode. I mean, this is, talk about star power.
Right. It's always very cool when somebody of a celebrity status takes a stand for something that you know is right. And we've been doing the series on John Juca, who was wrongfully imprisoned. He has been in prison for the murder of 19-year-old Mark Fisher. Everybody who follows the case knows this. And his mom, Doreen, has fought a battle for him. And part of the fight, part of his advocacy group, is a gentleman by the name of Holt McCallany.
Yep, you may know Holt McCallany as Bill Tench in Mindhunter. Mindhunter on Netflix has two seasons. It is an amazing show. Make sure to check that out if you haven't watched it, but I'm pretty sure everyone listening has at least checked it out. And Holt's character, Bill Tench, is actually sort of made up of the author of the Mindhunter book and creator, one of the creators of the series, John Douglas. So he kind of plays a personality of John Douglas in the show Mindhunter.
Now, they do a really good job taking characteristics of John Douglas, who was one of the founders of the behavioral science unit within the FBI. The main character, Holden Ford, is played by Jonathan Groff, and Bill Tench, as you said, is played by Holt McCallany.
And Holt is really an incredible advocate for the wrongful conviction of John Juca, as well as his mom, Doreen Quinn Giuliano. That's John Juca's mom. And Doreen herself is a notable figure because she went undercover to get a confession from one of the jurors who helped convict her son, John Juca, which is an absolutely incredible story. You'll want to check that episode out. We spoke to her in the past all about that. We touch on it a little bit in this episode, but you'll want to go back to an episode called Mother Justice to hear more about that. And there is an incredible article from Vanity Fair that is called Mother Justice. And there's a link to that in the show notes.
And also, Holt isn't just an advocate for John Juca. He is an advocate for all of the wrongfully imprisoned. He names several during this interview that he's been following and he's been an advocate for. And he's a very strong, staunch supporter of the criminal justice system. And he gets into that a little bit. And he also gets into just how much respect he has for John. John had an option to, hey, plea out. Say you're guilty. We'll let you out. We're going to hold you in Rikers for a little bit, obviously as an attempt to break him while they're transferring him from one prison to another. And Holt just has so much respect for him because he says he's not going, he didn't do it. He didn't do it, so he's not going to say he did it just to get out of prison. He's going to fight the fight and get out an innocent man. So that's that speaks to John's character. And you know that Holt is genuine because he's reading his files while we're talking to him. He's got the information in front of him for all of these wrongfully convicted people, which hopefully we can talk to him more about because he has a strong voice. He can broadcast that to a lot more ears than I think you know, this show can and some podcasts can.
Yeah, and we caught up with Holt while he was actually in quarantine waiting for another film shoot to start. He is in a new Guillermo del Toro movie. So how's that? Check out, go check out Hold McCallany's work. He's an incredible actor who is only becoming more well known with his acting.
Yeah, that Guillermo del Toro movie is called Nightmare Alley. Read a little bit about it. Sounds like it's going to be great. But yeah, we did catch up with him while he was in quarantine, and if he's listening now, it would just be, it'd make my day if he followed me on Twitter, if he followed me back on Twitter. So that's my personal plea.
Holt, I think you should block him on Twitter, but that's just me.
I think I will not accept that.
Okay, everybody. Thanks for listening. And thank you so much to Holt and Doreen for spending some time with us on this show and advocating for John Juca. So thanks for listening, everybody. Also, you can find all and only the John Juca episodes on a feed called Free John Juca that you can find in your favorite podcatcher if you want to check that out and just get to that. So, all right, everybody. Thanks a lot for listening. To the podcast, Holt and Doreen. How are you both today?
Good, good. Thank you for having me. Hi, Holt. How are you?
Hello, Doreen. Nice to see you.
Same here. Nice to see you. How have you been?
I've been well. Thank you.
Still in quarantine?
Yeah, I'm actually shooting a film in Toronto, Canada. And the Canadian government has a policy that anybody traveling from the United States has to do a mandatory 2-week quarantine. You know, the Canadians are very serious about it. In New York, the same thing exists, but it's essentially unenforceable. And frankly, a lot of people ignore it. In Canada, if you can imagine this, the fine for violating quarantine is $750,000 and 6 months in prison. And when they told me that, exactly, I thought, well, that can't possibly be the right number, but it is.
Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. It's been far too long, Doreen, since we spoke with you about your son, John, and the injustice that is happening with him, you know, on air. We do communicate with you on a regular basis. And thank you, Holt, for joining us. You are an extraordinary advocate for John. And I'm curious how that started. Where did you hear about his case, and how did you meet Doreen?
Yeah, so look, you know, there is a very long history of corruption in the office of the former district attorney of Brooklyn, the late Charles Hines. And I had a boyhood friend of mine who was wrongfully convicted of illegal voting. And that was a crime that nobody had been charged with in 100 years. It wasn't since Susan B. Anthony. He was a political opponent of Mr. Hines and had run, you know, candidates against Mr. Hines, and so they wanted to eliminate him. So they tried to get him, and this is like a really blatant example of prosecutorial misconduct and abuse of power. We'll talk about, you know, how prosecutorial misconduct also occurred in the case of John Juca. But you asked me how I got to know Doreen. So my friend John Kennedy O'Hara was convicted of illegal voting, of voting from a residence that was not his primary residence. That is defined under New York law as your principal and permanent residence to which you always intend to return. So it's because a lot of people do have multiple residences that, you know what I mean? It's a very sort of, you know, obtuse definition. And this is the reason that no one is ever charged with this crime. It really is, you know, if you'll pardon my French, a bullshit charge to bring against somebody. And, you know, eventually, after three trials, after having been convicted, after having been disbarred as an attorney, after having done thousands of hours of community service and, you know, and having his life destroyed and his livelihood taken away from him. Many years later, Mr. O'Hara was finally vindicated, you know, and the case was thrown out. But it took a very long time. And it was during this period when John, after John had been convicted, that we decided that we would work on a film project that was designed to call attention to the corruption in the DA's office. And an article, and I was collaborating on the project with a very good writer named Christopher Ketchum, who I believe you know, because he, you know, he's done some recordings of some of John's writings, and so have I. And if I'm not mistaken, you've played some of them.
Yeah. Yeah, and he wrote a great article. Yeah.
Right. And Chris had written a number of articles on this subject. And so he and I were collaborating on a screenplay. One of the Brooklyn papers ran an article about it. And Chris was contacted by Doreen. And we all met, you know, and she related to us the details of her case. I was appalled but not surprised. Because I had by that time become very familiar with the way things operated in the office of the now disgraced, you know, former DA Charles Hines. You know, I mean, look, I hate to speak ill of the dead, but it's well deserved in this case. So, you know, I went to visit John in prison, you know, on a number of occasions, and you know, I got to know him and see the kind of a man he is, and familiarize myself with the details of Doreen's case, and what it represents is just another in the long list of wrongful convictions. I mean, I could tell you, you know, some of the names of just the people that I know personally. Derek Hamilton, convicted of murder, right, and then exonerated, paid millions of dollars, right, by the city of New York. Jabbar Collins, convicted of murder, and then exonerated and paid millions of dollars. Oh, this is all under Charles Hines, right? Willie Lopez, right? Wrongfully convicted, paid millions of dollars. We can also talk about disgraced former NYPD detective Louis Scarcella, right? Who had 19 convictions, right? You know, thrown out. You know, just so far, the city of New York has paid $360 million, okay, wow, to people that have been wrongfully convicted by Charles Hines. And it's only that, it's only just begun. You know what I mean? It'll end up being $1 billion by the time it's through. So this is the way these guys operated. And it was for that reason that I became involved in the campaign to unseat Charles Hines. And I worked along with some friends of mine, you know, very diligently for the man who succeeded Charles Hines, Ken Thompson. And Ken Thompson was the first guy to unseat an elected district attorney in 100 years. Because the truth is about the district attorney's office is, you know, you've got hundreds of employees. It's a very powerful position. You're the highest law enforcement officer, you know, in the county. You know, all the judges are beholden to you. We can talk about that. You know, and generally these guys, they don't retire. They either try to run for governor or, do you know what I mean? Or they're in office, you know, for life. But not Charles Hines, because the voters, you know, finally wised up to the fact, you know, of you know, what kind of a guy this was and how he, you know, how he operated, and they voted him out. And then what happened was Mr. Thompson started something called the Conviction Integrity Unit. You know what I mean? And, you know, and some of these crimes, you know, were finally, you know, some of these people were finally vindicated. I mean, anyway, I don't want to talk on. I'll let you guys ask questions, but you asked how I got to know Doreen and how I became interested in the case. That was how.
Right. We had the mutual friend, John. I had reached out to John because I seen his name in the newspaper, and he was being wrongfully prosecuted also. So I reached out to him, and he is the one that actually brought me to Christopher Ketchum.
Oh, it was John. Yeah.
I actually, this article was written by Chris. And so I called Chris. I got in touch with Chris and I said, who is this John O'Hara guy? And he's like, oh, well, he doesn't have email. He doesn't have a cell phone, you know, but I'll get in touch with him. So we met for dinner. So I meet for dinner, Holt. I don't know if you remember this. We meet for dinner And I had just finished my undercover work. I just finished it up. And I didn't tell anybody about it yet. So we're talking and he's telling me how he was wrongfully targeted. And I said, well, you know, my son, John Juca also. And he says, well, I got to take you to Chris. Maybe Chris could write about this. I said, thank you. And then I opened up to him and I started telling him about when I went undercover. And he's looking at me at the restaurant and he's like, he goes, do you work for Charles Hines? Are you bugged? I was like, no, right? So he was like, okay. So then he finally came around and he believed me. And he told me that you need to go back undercover and get some pictures of this guy. I was terrified. I was like, no, I can't. I gained weight. My hair went brown again. I was like, I can't do it. He said, no, you got to get a picture to prove it. What if people think that, you know, the juror is actually your brother on the tape? And I was like, no. He goes, no, you have to prove that you had a relationship with this guy. And he was a corrupt juror. He committed serious misconduct in the jury box. So I went back undercover under the advice of John O'Hara. So I'm so glad I did. And I did get that picture that ended up going in the Vanity Fair because he introduced me to Chris. And then eventually they introduced me to you. And that was like 2008, I think. So we go back.
So that picture in Vanity Fair with you and the bicycle, that was when you went back undercover?
The picture of her and what's his name? Jason Allo.
Oh.
Was taken in the bar, was actually correct. Taken by John O'Hara.
Correct.
Right? So,
we concocted that whole plan. I was like, no, I was too nervous. I said, how am I going to get a picture? It's going to be so obvious. He goes, okay, so you tell him to meet you in a bar, and I will just stroll by, and you say, hey, sir, can you take a photo of me and Jason Allo? I was like, okay. So I did. I called him up, and we met in a pub, and we're drinking, and there John O'Hara comes walking in. And I said, excuse me, sir. That's when it was just a regular portable, you know, camera. A throwaway is what I called him. And I said, sir, can you take our picture? And he took the infamous picture of Jason Allo and I. Yeah. So wow. that was way back. Yeah. And then they started talking and I was sweating the whole time.
But just to follow up for one more moment, you know, on the way, because this is really at the core of the whole thing. It's the problem with our justice system, which is that nobody prosecutes prosecutors. They have something called prosecutorial immunity. Yes. And they advance their careers by getting convictions, right? And they know that the resources at their disposal will only allow them to bring 1% of their cases to trial. Not 2%, not 5%. They don't have the resources. So what are they in the business of? They're in the business of making plea bargains. And they expect, you know, criminal defendants to take a deal. And and you're under a lot of pressure to take a deal. And one of the reasons that I have such admiration for Doreen's son, John, is because, you know, of his refusal to do that, to acquiesce to that, and to maintain his evidence, even when you know the possibility of walking out of prison, you know, after many, many years was put in front of him, and he said no because he's innocent and because he had the courage to do that. But what Hines was finally. Eventually, what started people to realize what some of the problems were in the DA's office under Charles Hines was that he was using funds that are called asset forfeiture. So what is asset forfeiture? Asset forfeiture is, let's say there's a drug bust and they find, you know, $100,000 in cash, do you know what I mean, in an apartment with drugs and with weapons and whatever. What do? They confiscate that money. Where does that money go? That money goes into the asset forfeiture fund in the district attorney's office. And then the district attorney, believe it or not, has discretion over how those funds are going to be used. And in theory, they're supposed to be used for other investigations and stuff like that. Well, what Hines was doing was using those funds for his reelection campaign. He was paying his staffers. He was using the funds to renovate houses for his children in Breezy Point. Do you know what I mean? I would refer the audience to an article that was written in the New York Times in June of 2014, right, about Charles Hines and about this whole issue. You know, he was being threatened with indictment by the attorney general and eventually paid a $40,000 fine in order to avoid the indictment, you know, but even that deal should never have happened. You know, but by that time, he's a very old man in his 80s, in poor health. He's been disgraced. He's been kicked out of office. And I think the attorney general's, you know, idea was, you know, why beat a dying horse? But, you know, what's right is right. So this is what happened. He would also target his political opponents. So my friend John O'Hara was one of those, right? Tried three times for illegal voting. The first time in 100 years. This is voting from his girlfriend's apartment, which is in the same district. It's a few blocks away. Changes, you know. So, and then Sandra Roper, right, who is now a civil court judge, right, ran against Mr. Hines for district attorney, you know, and captured like 35 or 36% of the vote, something like that, was there after indicted, right? She was acquitted.
Don't forget the Kung Fu judge.
Judge John Phillips, right, who was, you know, a very well-respected judge, African-American, one of the first African-American judges in New York, and a real leader in his community, decided, you know, on the advice of our friend John O'Hara, to run against Charles Hines. And the reason that Charles Hines was particularly worried about Ms. Roper and Mr. Phillips was that they were African-American candidates, right? And remember that Ken Thompson was an African-American candidate who was the one who finally unseated Mr. Hines, because there is a large African-American community in Brooklyn, and Mr. Hines felt that he was particularly vulnerable. And so, you know, in the case of John Phillips, what he got away with is like something that you would expect to hear about, like in Alabama in the 1940s or something. He literally had this old guy, you know, ruled incompetent. You know, it was like an ex parte, you know, which means that, you know, it's a sealed, you know, document that is not able to be viewed by the public. You know, and then he seized the judge's assets. And the judge was confined, you know, to a nursing home. He literally, guys, you know, detectives from the district attorney's office busted into his house in Brooklyn. They put him in the car and they drove him and they locked him up and he died in there. You know, so this was, you know, the kind of guy that Mr. Hines was. And he got away with it for 20 or plus years. And, you know, it got so bad that he was actually even paying like low-level campaign workers with checks that came directly from the asset forfeiture fund. I mean, and you would think, well, wouldn't he as the DA be smart enough to cover his tracks a little bit better than that, at least to transfer those funds, you know, to an election campaign fund and then pay them from that? But when you've been getting away with something for so long, when it's happened so many times over and over and over, it becomes normal behavior. You just forget. I think, you know, it was just such a standard operating procedure within his office that they didn't think twice about it. Like Louis Scarcella, the NYPD detective, you know, who would use the same witness at trial over and over again in homicide cases. You know, this woman who, you know, had been a prostitute, a drug addict, you know what I mean? She just happens to witness murders. And she, you know, and there, I mean, you know, even the most cursory, you know, the most objective analysis of what was going on would show you that something is terribly wrong. It's like, you know, as I know Doreen discussed in the last podcast that you guys had her on, you know, when prosecutor Anastasia Nicolazzi went to a low, the star homicide prosecutor in the district attorney's office goes to a low level drug case to appear before the judge, you know, for the benefit of John Avito, a career criminal and hopeless drug addict, who testified against John at his trial, who of course has since recanted. I was in the courtroom when he was on the stand and when he was cross-examined by Mark Bettereau, a fabulously gifted attorney who has been representing John for a number of years now. And it was one of the most dramatic things that I've ever seen in my life, you know, and you know, and I'm an actor, you know, I mean, that's what we do. We do drama. But when you see something like he broke down in tears and he said to John, he said, "I'm so sorry for what I did. I lied. I was afraid I was going to go to prison. And so I lied. And as a result of that, you were convicted and you've been in prison all the, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry for what I did."
Even John, my son, started crying, right, Holt? There wasn't a dry eye in that courtroom. Everybody was so emotional because.
Well, there was one dry, forgive me for interrupting you, Doreen. There was one dry eye, and that's the judge, Danny Chun.
Yeah.
No matter what Mr. Chun sees, none of it seems to have any effect on his rulings, because, you know, I mean, he has, you know, steadfastly carried water for the prosecutors from the very beginning of this thing. And, you know, and that's another thing, you know, if we had more time, you know, we could talk about, you know, the relationship between judges and prosecutors. Do you see what I mean? And how that functions and how that's another conflict within our justice system, because, you know, the prosecutors are in many cases, the judges are in many cases afraid to alienate the prosecutors, especially on high profile cases like that of our friend John Juca.
Going back to Anastasia Nicolazzi, I mean, there's some other cases that are coming down the pipeline that accuse her of serious misconduct. And that's Jermaine Cox and Dimitri Williams, Joel Roberts. So they are going to be coming, down the pipeline real soon. And going back to that money that you were talking about, Holt, the forfeiture money, it reminded me of how Anastasia Nicolazzi got a $43,000 raise immediately after she got the conviction on John.
The
incentive is money and winning and more power, and it just $43,000 raise is unheard of.
Well, you see, Ms. Nicolazzi, right, famously will proclaim to anyone who will listen that she has never lost a case. Never lost a case, really. Well, I would argue that part of the reason for that is because they bend the rules and because they withhold evidence, which is beneficial to the defense, because they coerce testimony, they threaten witnesses, they engage in a variety of types of prosecutorial misconduct, and they're virtually never called on the carpet for it. And even in those cases where, you know, it can be established, there isn't really a penalty. It's not like they're going to be then charged, you know what I mean, with some sort of, you know, in some sort of criminal, you know, criminal charge for their behavior. Go ahead, Doreen, what were you going to say?
If anything, they're protected. They're protected. Mm-hmm. And they advance their careers because they have perfect records. Right. Some of them end up working, you know, for the defense. They
right.
end up working for a firm. They become judges.
Right.
And with Anna Nicolazzi, she became a actress. And is now working on that.
I think the word actress is stretching it.
Okay.
You know, I wouldn't quite go to that. But she has a TV show. Let's put it that.
Right. So
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she, but her signature case that she brags about is John Jukas.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's really.
You know, I know you guys are already familiar with the details of John's case, so we don't have to go all over all of that.
I like to mention them over and over. I mean, there were four recantations, right? Everyone recanted but one person.
Right. No murder weapon. No forensic evidence. Nobody can tie him to the scene of the crime. No witnesses, you know, that haven't recanted. They don't have a case.
He said, she said. And now we have all these recantations and all the misconduct. And don't forget, now why we're back in court is because of the hidden recording. There was another jailhouse informant named Joseph Ingram. And that tape just appeared, I want to say a year ago. And it was of John's co-defendant, confessing to the crime.
And saying that John had nothing to do with it.
Thank you. And it was his gun, and John had nothing to do with it. And Anna Nicolazzi hid that tape.
Right.
It was beneficial to us.
So now, you know, it's back in court, you know, on yet anew. You know, I was present at the New York State Court of Appeals, right, when Mr. Bettereau, you know, made the argument to uphold the lower court's decision to vacate John's conviction. And the Court of Appeals offered a decision that I still can't believe. It's like if Franz Kafka wrote a novel about it, you would say, you know, you've gone too far. Their decision said, well, even if it's true, it wouldn't have changed the outcome. Really?
There was prosecutorial
misconduct. Are you inside the minds of the jurors?
Very good.
You can say that beyond a reasonable doubt, it's right? So that a Brady violation, that the withholding of that would not have influenced the jury? You can say that for certainty and, you know, and condemn a young man, you know what I mean, to spend years and years and years of his life in prison for a crime he didn't commit because you say that prosecutorial misconduct had no, and wouldn't have had an outcome on that. I mean, it's a disgrace.
It's insulting to the whole system to say that, to not have the faith in the jury that they would understand something like that, because that's how I'm taking it. Like, I'm on a jury and you think I'm not going to be able to understand it, so therefore it's not going to have an influence on me? Like, he's simultaneously disgracing the process of having a jury in the first place.
That's frustrating.
They go into that trial and they're already, you know, they're already predisposed, you know what I mean, to have a very negative orientation toward the defendant. Why? Because he didn't take a deal. Do you see what I mean? They expect you to cop to something. They want you to say, okay, well, I'll take a somewhat reduced charge and I'll go away for 15 years and not risk 25 or something like this, so that they don't have to, because they can't bring every case to trial. So this is why John O'Hara, right, was finally vindicated after three trials, after being convicted on a trumped up charge, because they offered him deal after deal after deal after deal. You know what I mean? Just say you did it and all will be forgotten. Well, the problem is I didn't do it, so I'm not going to say that, you know, and that was John's position. And so then, you know, you put them in the position of having to use all the means at their disposal, and it's formidable, to try, you know, to destroy you. And if they have to bring in a jailhouse snitch and put him on the stand to perjure himself, if they have to lie about the fact that he got a benefit for that testimony, like not having to go to prison, that seems to me like a benefit, right? You know, and then they'll just get up and say, well, no, you know, now, you know, yes, he's made a lot of mistakes. Yes, he's committed many crimes. Yes, he was a hopeless drug addict. But on this occasion, he's telling the truth. Because he finally had that come to Jesus moment where he decided that it's time for him to do good in his life. Well, no, he didn't.
That's right. No, he didn't. Mm-hmm. And what did Judge Chun say? Chun had said when Evita finally confessed and said and apologized to John, Chun said that John Avito's testimony was laughable, but Anna Signicolazzi was credible.
Right. The problem is that John Avito is Anna Signicolazzi's star witness. So those two ideas don't go together.
No. So now we're going back to court. December, it was October, but they just postponed that for December 1st. And all these years, Tim, all these years, all I'm asking for is to give John a fair trial. Give him a fair trial so he could prove his innocence. Not where everyone lies, coerced, threatened, getting benefits. Just give John a fair trial is all I ask, and I can't seem to get that.
Well, there's a very simple reason that Doreen can't get that. Because they don't have any evidence. What are they going to go to trial with? There was never any physical evidence. There were never any eyewitnesses that put him at the scene. All of the witnesses have recanted. Go to trial with what? Their case has been reduced to rubble. And they know that. And, you know, I believe that, you know, it's the reputation of the district attorney's office. It's how much bad press is going to be generated, you know, by John's release. It's the millions and millions and millions of dollars that John is rightfully entitled to for having so many years of his life stolen for him. It's just going to be a black eye on their office. They'll do anything to try to avoid that. So, you know, this is why they fought so hard, you know, to try to keep John in prison.
And Doreen, I always want to ask. I never want an interview to go by without finding out how John is. How is he doing now?
Well, it's going on 16 years, and it's really hard. It's like he goes up and down. It's a roller coaster, and. Of course, we're praying for another reversal. If we get this reversal, what happens is they usually take you out of upstate and throw you in holding, which is Rikers Island. I call it the torture.
John was the last time I visited him, you know, and as I know you guys know, it's not a very pleasant place to be.
No. So they use Rikers Island to... get plea deals out of people. It's so horrendous there. It's so violent. John, when he was there last time, seen many, many stabbings. So he is terrified to go back to Rikers Island. And that's what would happen. If we were to get the reversal, of course we would ask for bail because he should get bail.
And John will refuse it. Do you see me as he's done in the past, you know, even though, you know, I mean, after a reversal, right? You know, the conviction has been reversed. So,
he's eligible.
Right.
No, but he wouldn't give it to him. He said no. So he had to wait over a year in Rikers Island. He's seen so much bloodshed. And, you know, that's going to end up happening again. I do believe we're going to get another reversal based on this hidden tape that Nicolazzi hid. Eric Gonzalez, our district attorney, will dig his heels in even further and protect Nicolazzi.
Right. And appeal it again. It goes back to the Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in the state of New York. And the risk is, of course, that they'll make a similar decision to the one they made last time, which is, yeah, well, you know, okay, this recording should have been, you know, given to the defense as evidence, but it wouldn't have changed the outcome anyway. When they can make that kind of an illogical conclusion, then you really, you don't think that you're in the United States anymore. You feel like you're in some third world banana republic where the courts, completely corrupt.
Right. Insane. Let me explain to your audience exactly what is on this recording. So there was another jailhouse informant, and he got in touch with Anna Sigal Nicolazzi, and they dragged him in. I believe this was in Rikers Island in 2005, before the trial. And he said that he had bumped into Antonio Russo. And Antonio Russo said to him that he did this and he did it alone, and John had nothing to do with it. And he also said that it was his gun and it wasn't John's gun. And that's very important because Nicolazzi hid that tape and used a DA witness that said that John gave Russo this gun to commit this crime. So it is very obvious if the defense would have had this knowledge, we would have used it to rebut her witness that said it was John's gun. Because this came out of the co-defendant's mouth. He said it was my gun, it wasn't John's gun. This was hidden, and it does matter. It matters a lot because it's in direct...
It's a Brady violation. I mean, is that
correct.
Not what it is?
Correct. It's a Brady violation.
Where is the oversight? Where I know we talk about this before. There's no oversight, right?
That you see, that's the problem. That's the problem is prosecutors operate with impunity. You know what I mean? They have prosecutorial immunity. You know what I mean? They advance their careers, as I said, by getting convictions. And so the need to do that and remain undefeated, you know what I mean? As though she were, a middleweight champion or something, they will use any means at their disposal. And that often means exactly what we're talking about here, withholding evidence, right? Coercing testimony, threatening witnesses, and even in this case, putting a career criminal on the stand to perjure himself.
God, it's going to be, the system has to be changed. It's not going to be easy, but I feel like the work that the two of you have put into John's case and the other cases, you just named off just off the top, other people that are wrongfully convicted. Our good friend Maggie Freeling just started her podcast called Unjust and Unsolved, which is about wrongfully convicted people as well. And they're, incarcerated still, and she has conversations with them. It's all of these little movements that I really hope build into a greater movement. And it's not easy. I just hearing you guys talk about it, every time we talk to Doreen, I get so fired up. I start to get like a hive on the back of my neck because I'm just like so fired up. It's so unbelievable to me that somebody can brag about a perfect record. Like you're saying, like a heavyweight champ.
It just shows you what's the problem that's inherent. You know what I mean? In the system is that record would be so important to her. What's important to her? Not the fact that justice is administered in an impartial way, right? No, it's preserving, this reputation that she has for being invincible as a prosecutor. And let me say one thing also, regarding my friend Doreen for a moment, because I got to go in a little while. But every son should be lucky enough to have a mother like Doreen Giuliano, because her efforts on behalf of her son have been so extraordinary. And, the fact that we're all sitting here right now talking about his case is because of her relentless advocacy on the part of her son. And it's inspiring to watch, Doreen, and I really admire you for it.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. You have an amazing mom, too.
I did. She's gone now.
She did. Yeah. But
yeah,
she stuck by you.
I got to know my mom. When she was still alive. And yes, I was.
And we bonded, your mother and I. Bonded for a bit there.
Absolutely.
Talking about your brother.
Right. Right.
Remember?
My late brother. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do. I remember very well.
Yeah, Holt, thank you so much for spending some time and coming on and talking to us about this case. And we're huge fans of yours and Mindhunter. We're true crime fanboys, really. So we're I've read the Mindhunter book.
Oh, there it is. There, yeah. I was wondering when that was going to make an appearance.
Right, right. Well, look, you know, the success of that television show is because we had a great director, a guy named David Fincher. You know, but also the source material, you know, is amazing. You know, John Douglas is a brilliant FBI detective. And actually, he has a brand new book called The Killer Across the Table.
Oh, my God, it's great.
So I'm going to do the audiobook. So for those people in your audience that might like true crime audiobooks, I'll be recording that later in the month, and it'll be available in just a few weeks.
Yeah, you're doing the audiobook for The Killer Across the Table.
I am.
That's wow, fantastic. You have the perfect voice for it.
That's fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
That is a tough book, by the way. That's got some moments in there that are kind of stomach churning for me.
For me too, you know. But yeah. But you know, when John called me, he had been so generous to me. You know, like, for example, when if you remember in Mindhunter in the second season, we devoted a lot of our time to the Atlanta child murders. And John, of course, was one of the all of his research, his entire file. Do you know what I mean? You know, the hundreds of pages and all everything about Wayne Williams, you know, to spend time with him at his house in Virginia, and was always like available to me, you know, to answer questions, which I always had. And just a great guy. So when he asked me to do the audiobook, I couldn't say no.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. That's perfect. Brilliant.
That's amazing.
You introduced me to him, Holt. Do you remember?
I do. We all had dinner. Yeah, right. Because he did a panel. Right. What's the name of the kid?
Amanda Knox
and the gentleman from the Norfolk. What's his name?
Damien Eccles.
Right. And Damien, another wrongful conviction. Right. You know what I mean? In the long, disgraceful history of wrongful convictions, let's right. put Damien Eccles right up there with John Juca and with all the guys I mentioned before. We got a real problem with our justice system, you know, and eventually it's going to have to be addressed. I mean, it's just, it can't go on like this.
So then you invited me to the show, the panel, right. And then you took a bunch of us out to this fancy restaurant.
We all went to dinner. It was John Douglas, and it was a great detective named Paul Holes, who was the guy who convicted the Golden State Killer, right? Who hit upon the idea of using, you know, the relationship DNA, and he told us all about that process. And, you know, when we got to reminisce with John about some of his famous cases, there are too many to list, you know, at the moment. But Doreen and I have been fortunate over the years to meet a lot of these guys and to hear their stories and stuff like, and to share, you know, the story, you know, of John's situation with them as well.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Is that the same dinner that that picture was taken where Stephen Colbert is in the background looking entirely confused?
I think it is.
Yes, it is.
He thought that it was all just an elaborate attempt to take his photograph. But Stephen, if you're watching, it wasn't. You just happened to be there at an adjacent table. That's all.
His expression was great. He was looking over like, can they keep it down? Can those guys keep it down?
We were loud and obnoxious.
Well, thank you.
Guys,
so
thank you so much. I really had a good time. It's a great podcast. You know, about having John O'Hara on. You know, if you're interested in wrongful convictions, he's got a great story too. And Doreen, please say hello to John for me.
Yes, I will. And he sends his love. He told me to say hi, and he sends his love.
Okay.
And he said he's staying strong.
I look forward to the day, Doreen, when he walks out of jail.
Thank you.
Thank you.